Well, thank you, Anselm, and indirectly, Tom, and thanks to everyone for making me part of this incredible project. Of course, as we've already heard, this fundamental opposition of prehistory and of history haunts this project, you might say. It has haunted the modern Western imaginary. The historical is traditionally identified with the emergence of empires that command some sort of writing system that allows those empires to write the history that they make and to make history by writing it. What went into museums such as the Louvre was essentially the history of such empires down to their latest European successors. But of course, the prehistoric itself is a contested field, and it is itself historical in nature. And we'll hear more, I think, in the next presentation about the distinction also between the Paleolithic and the Neolithic being associated, as we've already heard, with this notion of the Neolithic Revolution, the first agricultural revolution, possibly the beginning of the Anthropocene. But for the moment, I want to sort of stick with this very general trope of the prehistoric as such. This is the cover of the German edition of Upton Sinclair's 1925 polemic book, Mammon Art. So the English title is Mammon Art. In German, it was translated as Die Goldene Kette. And in this book, Sinclair returns to the primal scene of art, as he sees it, 100,000 years ago, when a caveman he names Oggy drew an aurochs in the sand, and Oggy then quickly realized that this visual magic made him attractive to the powers that be. This new visual magic could be used to underline the power, strengthen the power of witch doctors and tribal chiefs. Neither master nor slave, in Kojevian terms, and I'll return to Kojève later, neither master nor slave, the artist was nonetheless usually on the side of the masters that paid and employed him. Sinclair then follows Oggy through history. So Oggy is this kind of trans-historical figure of the artist throughout history. He follows Oggy through antiquity and the Middle Ages into the modern bourgeois world. For Sinclair, the entire history of art was prehistorical. It was the work of Oggy. And as John Hartfield's cover for the German edition here emphasizes, all art so far has been the art of class societies in the service of the ruling class of the moment. And the modern bourgeois capitalist, represented here by a George Gos drawing, inherits and embodies the entire history of art, which is thus the prehistory of art. And of course, this is also a Marxian trope. Marx wrote that the bourgeois mode of production is the last antagonistic form of the social process of production. The prehistory of human society accordingly closes with this social formation. This motif was then also picked up later after the Second World War by Guy Debord and the Situationists. So Marx's project is the project of a conscious history, Debord writes, in the society of the spectacle. The quantitative, which arises in the blind development of merely economic productive forces, must be transformed into a qualitative historical appropriation. The critique of political economy is the first act of this end of prehistory. So again, prehistory is something we still have to disentangle ourselves from. We still have to extract ourselves from that. And this motif was then also used by later post-situationist or pro-situ groups such as Jean-Pierre Voyer's Institut de Préhistoire Contemporaine, which published this Revue de Préhistoire Contemporaine. Voyer was a kind of hanger-on who was basically fired by by Debord from the Champs Libre publishing house in the early 70s and then developed his own post-situationist cottage industry. Now, while Sinclair and the Situationists indicted Western capitalist modernity as prehistoric, others basically said, well, if only that were the case, how can we reclaim the prehistoric, or how can we reclaim a mode of being, a form of life, and a form of art that is at cross purposes, that is actually at loggerheads with bourgeois capitalist Western society. And of course, we then also return to the whole problem of primitivism, because prehistory in the sense of the long durée of deep time, of dehistory, prehistory in the sense of the Paleolithic or the Neolithic, was then placed in a constellation with contemporary tribal art, which was actually seen as a contemporary version of prehistory, because these societies, of course, were supposedly locked in perpetual stasis and were not part of the prehistoric, of the historic process, and it was placed in a constellation with the art of children. In fact, as is evident from Georges Bataille's 1930 article in Documents, L'Art Primitif, the primitive became the very category that could unite the prehistoric past, the prehistoric present of tribal societies, and the art of children. Bataille's text is a book review. It is the review of a book by G.H. Luquet, and Luquet opposes the classical art of civilized adults, as he terms them, to another kind of art that we encounter at the same time in children and adults, even among professionals, and in the numerous and varied human milieus that prehistory, history, and ethnography have informed us about, end of quote. Now, Bataille says, and I quote again, this time Bataille says that the parallel between children and savages today belongs to a dismal pattern. And actually, this has been mistranslated in the only English translation that I know of this Bataille piece. In the English translation, it says it belongs in the world of a detective novel, or it's part of a detective novel, which is a bit of a misunderstanding, because the French term Bataille uses is une série noire, and the série noire, a series of crime novels, was only started in 1948. And série noire is a common idiomatic expression in France, in French, that refers indeed to some kind of horrible pattern. A series of terrorist attacks will invariably be called une série noire by the French press. So the parallel between children and savages today belongs to a dismal pattern. The times are past when a formula like ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny seemed to solve all the problems presented by the study of evolution, end of quote. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is, of course, a formula associated with Ernst Haeckel in particular. It encapsulates a conviction shared by Haeckel and many other biologists at the time, the conviction that the development of an embryo recapitulates the evolution of species, so evolution as a whole, in fast forward. So at a certain point, the embryo will look like a fish and then like a reptile and what have you, so a kind of a fast-forward, sped-up version of evolution in the development of the embryo. This evolutionary recapitulation theory, and many of you, of course, know this, was also applied to human evolution and to human culture. There is one linear development culminating in modern European man. Prehistoric culture was the childhood of the human species. Contemporary primitives are indeed stuck in a perpetual childhood and are therefore destined either to be civilized by Europeans or to disappear from the face of the earth, which for them pretty much amounts to the same thing. And children, in turn, recapitulate in their development that of the human species. And children are indeed a recapitulation of the earlier phases of human evolution, of humanity's childhood. Now, Bataille actually makes a series of critical comments in his book review. Again, he calls the parallel between children and savages une série noire, while not completely dismantling the homologies on which this cultural recapitulation theory, on which this evolutionism was based. He notes, for instance, ironically, that the early cave painters created strikingly realistic depictions of animals, which is not in keeping with Luquet's definition of primitive art as being based on a kind of intellectual realism. These early cave paintings of animals are far too realistic, actually, by Luquet's standards, which basically leads Bataille to make the ironic comment that clearly these people knew nothing of primitive art. They were sort of too primitive to know what primitive art was supposed to be. One could say that this is an imminent critique of recapitulation theory. It is a detournement of evolutionism rather than a complete negation, because in as we've already heard, basically, of course, Bataille, Einstein, various others around 1930, as radical as they may have been, they were, of course, not able to extract themselves from this horizon and to immediately place themselves in the year 1950 or 1960 or 1970 or what have you. They tinkered with, they tampered with the categories provided by late 19th century anthropology, ethnography, cultural theory. In an act of bricolage, you might say, they suggested different readings of these relations between these terms that they too consider to be interrelated. The child, prehistoric man, the contemporary, savage or primitive. And of course, we also see this in the article by Carl Einstein that provided the title for this exhibition, for this project. And this article also, you know, like some of the others, makes for some uncomfortable reading because Einstein does remain within this horizon and there is no complete negation of this framework. There is rather a play with a deforming, a mutation, a detournement of various categories that are profoundly problematic and deeply compromised. I would agree with something suggested by Joyce Chen when she noted that what Einstein does, for instance, in relation to the notion of childhood in this essay is that he reconfigures childhood as an experiential modality rather than as an evolutionary phase. Because I think this is what a lot of the tampering, let's say, with the evolutionary framework really amounts to in the circles around documents in particular. It is a challenge posed to linear evolutionary models. It is also a challenge posed to notions such as that of regression. So a seeming return to an earlier phase should not necessarily be considered to be a pathological regression at the very least. So there is the suggestion that indeed history is made up of, or that history constitutes a fractured, anachronistic continuum of the prehistorical or the primitive, that we can discern this kind of anachronistic, transhistorical, fractured continuum throughout history, and that this continuum can be polemically opposed to a different kind of continuum, a different kind of history, which is precisely the history that culminated in the civilized bourgeois modern capitalist West. And I will develop this a little bit further in relation to the work of Georges Bataille later on, because I think Bataille is the one who pushed this kind of imminent critique or this kind of imminent dis and reassembling of evolutionism the furthest. But perhaps first, another quick look at some related positions. For instance, this is Brassailles, and this article, like many other images that I show, actually I realized that this morning when I had a first look at the exhibition. This is also in the exhibition, Brassailles' article, Du mur des cavernes au mur d'usine, so from the wall of the caves to the wall of the factory wall. And this is an article based on Brassailles' own photographs of graffiti in Paris in particular. And there is, the suggestion here of a continuum, not of an evolution, a continuum that is, of course, also quite speculative. It is not something backed up by a serious theory. Brassailles is not a respectable serious theorist. It's basically the suggestion that there is something here, that there is something to be gained from drawing this tentative, speculative continuum from the wall of the caves, the prehistoric caves, to the factory wall. And, well, what is actually then the basis for suggesting this at all? Well, it's purely actually the act of making marks. So there is no grand theory in Brassailles about, let's say, primitive mentality, about the mythical primitive worldview. There is also no sense that these graffiti actually are formally that closely linked to prehistoric arts. He doesn't make very specific formal comparisons at all. It is neither, let's say, primitive mentality nor strict, precise formal homologies. No, it is the act of mark making, of basically defacing a surface, which is, of course, something that was an important, crucial human activity for Bataille as well, even though this article was published in Minotaure and not in documents. Now, Brassailles was also close to Picasso, obviously, as most of you will know. And when seeing Picasso's sculptural experiments in Bois-Geloup, Brassailles was reminded of Neolithic idols or the graffito on Parisian walls. So again, we have this presentness and this presence of the prehistoric. We have Neolithic idols and graffito on Parisian walls, and they in turn both remind Brassai of Picasso's work. I have some photos here. In the middle is a photo of Picasso with one of his sculptures taken by Brassai. And on the top is the so-called Venus of Lepuc, a French prehistoric figurine whose sexual semiotics, with the emphasis on the secondary sexual characteristics, seems to have fascinated Picasso, because he owned two different casts of that figurine, as Brassai notes in his book of Conversations with Picasso. Now, in these conversations, the prehistoric is indeed constantly present. At the bottom here, we see one of the pebbles that Picasso engraved in painstaking labor with a face in this case. And at one point in the interviews, in the conversations with Brassai, Picasso jokes about these engraved pebbles that he would like to throw them back into the sea in order for them to puzzle future archaeologists, right? So let's see what they would make of this in the future. And of course, here we touch on the issue of decontextualization, right? So the abstraction of art, of artifacts, from their original context. Now, for Picasso, this was not a problem at all. Picasso embraced decontextualization. He embraced this kind of abstraction. And of course, his art, some of his art, was also very much grounded in the violent extraction of African artifacts from its original context. But for Picasso, actually, art was a semiotic activity for which you didn't need a whole lot of context. The text, the sign, was enough. In one of his other interviews, not with Brassai, Picasso insisted that art is a question of science. It has been agreed upon, I quote Picasso, it has been agreed upon that a specific sign represents a tree, another a house, a man or a woman, exactly as in language the word man invokes the image of a man. Well, not exactly, we might of course say. This is Picasso's own homespun semiotics. Long before Eva Lambois and Rosalind Krauss subjected Picasso's art to a semiological reading. But so for Picasso, art is indeed an art, an act of sign-making based on pretty elementary, supposedly trans-historical, trans-cultural, and therefore all but universal conventions. So who needs context, in a sense? Now, this is another magazine page, actually, or another journal page that is also in the exhibition, from A bis Z, which is the Cologne Progressives organ, edited by Franz Wilhelm Seiwert. And on this front page, Seiwert again uses ARP as his point of departure, just as Einstein used ARP as his springboard for the Neolithic Childhood article. And Seiwert notes that with ARP, with ARP's art, science had become autonomized and individualized to the point of being disconnected from meaning, right? So as Picasso actually says, we should get to a point of simplification where art actually can communicate across cultures, even though it may puzzle future archaeologists because they wonder about the context, but still at an elementary level, it's readable. Seiwert, on the contrary, Seiwert as a historical thinker, as a dialectical thinker, argues that art has become autonomized as a sign-making activity to the point where those signs no longer have any sort of shared, are no longer part of any shared cultural idiom. They no longer truly communicate, but for Seiwert, again as a dialectician, this is actually then the first step towards the elaboration of neue kollektive Verständigungsmöglichkeiten, new ways of collective communication. So this is sort of the point zero of signification, and on this basis we can build a new collective art. So what we see here precisely in discussions around 1930 about art as a semiotic activity, art about sign-making, is a fundamental conflict, you might say, between a kind of semiotic universalism, as in Picasso's sexual paleosemiotics, on the one hand, and an attempt to historicize, to dialecticize art as semiotic activity. Art has indeed reached a point zero of meaning, of signification, and on the basis of this, actually, a new culture will have to be created. Now, the transcultural aspect and the transhistorical aspect that Picasso focuses precisely by abstracting from all particulars and making rather sweeping statements, the transcultural and transhistorical element actually features sometimes in, let's say, rather jokey or in-jokey varieties in a lot of avant-garde journals such as Documents. This is, on the one hand, a pretty, let's say, practical matter here. This is something that occurred a lot in Documents. So what we see on the left-hand side is an article, is a photograph that belongs to the previous article, to the preceding article. It does not actually belong to the article that begins on the right, which is about Neolithic figurines from Japan. On the left is a sculpture by Jacques Lipschitz. But I'm pretty convinced that Bataille savored this brief moment of temporal and cultural disorientation, this brief moment of how does this relate to each other, where indeed one would be tempted, albeit for the fraction of a second, to read the Lipschitz figure in conjunction with the title Neolithic figurines from Japan. This, of course, is again an act of decontextualization, an act of de- and recontextualization that also actually took far more critical forms in this same period. So we've already seen actually, or you can see in the exhibition, you can see various photographs from the 1931 anti-colonial exhibition, La Vérité sur la Colonie. And here, actually, the surrealists acting in collaboration with, or almost also as a kind of front for the Communist Party and the Comintern, staged an anti-colonial exhibition in opposition to the official colonial exhibition, in which they put the label of fetishes onto European colonial and exoticist bric-a-brac. So here again we move closer to Marx, and we move closer to the Marxian appropriation of terms from 18th and 19th century anthropology, ethnography, and history, world history. Just as Marx applied the label of prehistory to Western capitalist modernity, he of course famously took the label, the concept of the fetish, and applied it not to let's say, African tribal societies and their artifacts, but to the commodity, as in commodity fetishism. And the surrealists, in a sense, actually sort of re-anthropologized the notion of the fetish, the Marxian take on the fetish, by labeling these colonial artifacts fetiche européen, so a kind of collection box for mission work, a black statuette of the Madonna and the baby Jesus and some kind of erotic exotic dancer. These become fetiche européens. So here we have a de- and recontextualization of European artifacts that indeed has an explicit anti-colonial message, even though, of course, both the Breton-led Orthodox surrealists and the Bataillean radicals in many ways remained entangled in the categories, in the concepts of 19th century and early 20th century Western colonial era science. Still, even if this is still very much a kind of Kunstgeschichte der Kontaktlosigkeit, to refer to Susanna's talk, it still could be said to have laid the basis or a basis for a an art history of contact, Christian Cavagna's term, an art history of contact that actually the surrealists would later begin to develop when they entered into alliances with, for instance, Aimé Césaire and others from the Caribbean. Not all the anthropologists, not all the ethnographers that the surrealists or the Bataille circle took pointers from, took cues from, were, of course, models of progressivism, not even by the standards of the 1920s and 1930s. A case in point is Leo Frobenius, the self-made ethnologist who started out actually by focusing on contemporary North African art, but who then shifted his attention to both South European and North African prehistoric cave paintings or rock paintings, and who used an evolutionary framework, or who worked within an evolutionary framework in which contemporary Africans were seen as the degraded, degenerated descendants of the Stone Age Hochkultur that had produced the rock paintings he studied, and that he had copied by a whole army of mostly female assistants during copying campaigns in situ, an entire musée imaginaire of hand-drawn and hand-painted copies of those works was produced, and those were then in turn exhibited in the West. So on the left here you see an article by Frobenius from Documents, invited by Bataille to contribute to Documents, a selection of the Frobenius copies was exhibited that same year, 1930, in Paris at the Salle Pleyel, where Picasso and Bataille were among those invited to the opening, so their names are on the list of invitees, and also in New York's Museum of Modern Art in 1937, prehistoric rock pictures in Europe and Africa, and then later, after the Second World War, 40,000 years of modern art, the inaugural exhibition of the ICA in London, again contained copies from the Frobenius collection. Now here we see how a certain, interest in the trans-historical and trans-cultural agency of artifacts from prehistoric cultures leads to a certain set of conventions and to a certain narrative, a paradoxical, perverse narrative of sameness, you might say, or of recurrence, the eternal recurrence of the prehistoric and the modern art of Miro, of Picasso, and so on, as something that appears to exist in a direct dialogue with art from completely different historical and cultural context. And then, of course, often in those publications and exhibitions, more direct formal homologies would be suggested than, for instance, in the case of Brassai. So we see indeed with Carola Gideon and others that there are these pairings of images that suggest that indeed there is a kind of correspondence here on the formal level. Now, we could unpack this much further, and of course the exhibition also provides a lot of material for doing that, but I would like to actually spend a bit more time, as much as I still have left basically, on a rather different project maintained by, developed by Georges Bataille from the 1930s into the 1940s and 1950s, so also spanning basically the pre-war and the post-war period, in which Bataille developed his earlier Documents era readings of prehistoric art into a more fully fledged, fully developed theory, a theory of basically human culture, a theory of hominization, and basically a theory of different ways of being human, different ways of different forms of life, basically, and different modes and modalities of being human. And we've already seen, of course, Bataille in Lascaux, in the cave of Lascaux, which was only actually discovered in 1940. And then after the war, Bataille was hired by Skira to produce a fancy coffee table book, basically, about this cave, which is an amazing artifact in its own right. And from Bataille's early notes around 1930, about prehistoric cave art to his late work, there's an interesting set of operations that he performs and that he refines over time. One crucial element for him that became important, that became a reference for him in the course of the 1930s, was Alexandre Kojève's freestyle interpretation of Hegel's master-slave dialectic. So for Kojève, history was one great fight between master and slave. So, you know, whether it's officially known as prehistory or as history, from the earliest days, from what we think of as prehistory, down to the era of the French Revolution and Napoleon, it is one long, long historical fight. History is that fight, and then with the emergence of the Napoleonic state, with what Kojève called the universal and homogeneous state under Napoleon, history had come to an end. So from prehistory, which for Kojève never really was prehistory, to post-history, to the post-histoire. Now, Bataille blended Kojève's interpretation of history, Kojève's interpretation of Hegel, with Nietzsche, with Marcel Mauss and others, to develop an account of the human as a fallen animal mired in self-consciousness, in a world of toil and utility, which can, however, be transgressed and transcended in acts of excessive expenditure, excessive expenditure of waste, transgressive rituals, eroticism, and art. Bataille notes that actually the earliest cave paintings are already reactions to the emergence of the Homo Faber, man the tool maker and tool user. Actually, this was the first negation for Bataille of the animal, when man, the human being, started using tools and indeed became human in the process. But it was a specific type of human that emerged in the process, precisely Homo Faber, a being that is indeed trapped in a world of tool making and tool using, in a world of labor. This, for Bataille, is a world of homogeneity. On the other hand, then, the cave paintings for Bataille signal the emergence of Homo sapiens, properly speaking, or actually Homo ludens, as Bataille called this human by using Huizinga's term. So in the cave paintings, in the early prehistoric cave paintings, we see the emergence actually of this Homo ludens who transcends and transgresses this world of tools and labors. And the early cave paintings, such as Lascaux, focus on the animal and depict animals far more realistically than humans, precisely because man became aware of the fact that actually the animal is truly sovereign, because the animal is not bound by the diktats of use value, of utility. The animal kills basically at will and has no sort of social codex to speak of. This sovereignty had been lost. And for Bataille, basically, then history becomes a series of attempts to recreate a form of contact with this heterogeneous world of sovereignty, with what cannot be contained by the laws of use of social norms and conventions that are about perpetuating the social order. So again, acts of eroticism, the potlatch, ritualistic waste, and indeed art, a certain kind of art. So yes, Bataille then posited a continuum between prehistoric cave art, between contemporary tribal societies, various rituals with roots in pre-modern, pre-accumulationist societies, forms of eroticism, certain forms of transgressive art, and in some of his books, in for instance the book L'érotisme, Eroticism, there is this amazing montage of images that skip and jump from Lascaux, obviously, to Brazilian voodoo rituals, to Goya, to Aztec human sacrifices, Indian temples, particularly gruesome kinds of Christian art, and so on. So what Bataille in fact says is that what we may think of as the primitive, or what the 19th and 20th century in the West may have conceptualized as the primitive, isn't actually really the primitive. What we think of the primitive art, prehistoric art, etc., is already a reaction to. It is already a next step, let's say, that responds to the emergence of Homo Faber. Homo Faber actually... The form of human being, the form of human life that, according to Bataille's reading, completely dominates modern Western society, is in a sense the original form of humanity, the original form of humankind. Because Bataille, of course, read the modern industrialized capitalist West in terms of toil, labor, use value, utility. This was indeed the triumph of Homo Faber. This was the triumph of homogeneity. And modern art, modern transgressive activities or transgressive activities in these societies can indeed be placed in a conjunction with older prehistoric or tribal activities precisely insofar as they enact a protest insofar as they constitute a reaction against a kind of modernity that is itself timeless, the modernity of the Homo Faber, the modernity of tools, toil, and labor. And there is, in a sense, a different modernity that is the modernity of transgression, of waste, of excessive rituals. So this is, I would say, Bataille's slightly more systematic, to the extent that Bataille, of course, ever deigned to be systematic, but this is Bataille's somewhat more systematic development of these earlier 1930-ish, circa 1930-era attempts to detour, to appropriate the concepts, the evolutionist concepts of 19th and early 20th century Western colonial science. Now, I would like to end then on basically a juxtaposition of two recent projects. I'm going to jump to the present now, because what I think is important sort of to take away from Bataille's working with and through these problematic categories, his his insistence that there are different forms of humanity, that there are different modes of being human, of being in the world, of making art, Bataille's insistence on differentiation, on critical discrimination, his rejection of a kind of blanket humanism, right, that says, oh, we're all one. Bataille is against this kind of family of man type humanist universalism. So this kind of Bataillean distinction, I would actually like to flesh out a bit further and place in conjunction with two recent projects. On the left is a photograph of one of the so-called Guayan or Bradshaw rock paintings from Australia. And this art, this rock art, was used as the basis for the project Allegory of the Cave Painting in 2014-2015. This was a project by Extra City in Antwerp. And in Allegory of the Cave Painting, the organizers basically took as their point of departure the insight that these paintings are very much sort of, that they have a very rich and complex and layered temporality and historicity. So on the one hand, their origin is contested. Western or white Australian evolutionary scientists have tended to argue that they could not possibly have been painted by the direct ancestors of the Aborigines who live on that land currently. So there has been this kind of Frobenius style attempt to posit a lost ancient prehistoric Hochkultur, of which the contemporary Aborigines are perhaps not even the descendants, not even the degenerated descendants. But in recent times, actually, it has been acknowledged that probably indeed there is a direct link. In any case, the contemporary Aborigines are usually seen as the traditional owners, the traditional caretakers of those of those paintings, of that cave art. However, another layer comes into view when it was discovered that actually these paintings are very much alive, in that there is a whole coating of microorganisms containing black fungi and red cyanobacteria that actually make sure that these paintings still look remarkably fresh. So this is sort of living pigment. And there is indeed then this co-presence not only of different forms of humanity, different forms of humankind that all have various stakes, that all have various perhaps also conflicting investments in those paintings, but there is also indeed the presence of non-human participants, of non-human agents that actually make sure that the paintings look the way they look. So this is, in a sense, a kind of wet dream for contemporary theory, right? I mean, it's perfect. It's almost too perfect. But indeed, here we go from this kind of early 20th century to mid 20th century attempt to differentiate between different modes of art making and different modes of being in a non sort of evolutionary manner, in a non-hierarchical manner, we go to this kind of contemporary montage and a contemporary understanding of contemporaneous co-presence. However, on the other hand, there is this project by Trevor Paglen, also from a couple of years ago, called The Last Pictures, which involved Trevor Paglen basically shooting a picture archive, a photo archive, into outer space with a satellite. And this picture archive contains quite a few images also of prehistoric cave paintings, Lascaux in particular. This is one element among others, but there are quite a few of those. And actually, this picture archive does function as a contemporary version of the family of man, in a sense. It does claim to or pretend to give an overview of human life on Earth. So it does use a rather universalizing humanist rhetoric, you might say, but with a post-humanist twist, because actually this picture archive, The Last Pictures, is presented as a collection of images in orbit for, and I quote Paglen, the descendants of future dinosaurs or giant squid to find. So it is basically a picture archive for future alien astronauts, you know, from sort of a future era long after we are all extinct. So this is, in a sense, a picture archive that turns all of us into not so much prehistoric as it turns all of us into dinosaurs, essentially, right? We are not just prehistoric human beings, but we are the dinosaurs in this image archive with The Last Pictures. We can kind of savor, we can contemplate our own impending extinction. But in the process, Paglen, of course, then resurrects a certain a rhetoric that I indeed would associate with the post-war era, with the 50s in particular, a rhetoric of humankind, of the family of man, right? And we're all about to indeed go the way of the dodo, while on the other hand, the Allegory of the Cave Painting project, for all its faults and for all the criticisms one could level at it, actually is interested in continuing the difficult labor of being human in different ways, in different modes and modalities, while we have still time.